This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Every day, 91 Americans die from an opioid overdose. North Carolina loses about 1,000 people per year to opioid addiction. It's rampant, and it constitutes the deadliest drug crisis this state and this nation have ever faced. As we've discussed in previous programs on the topic, by the way, you can hear those programs at wfae.org/charlottetalks. As we've talked about this on previous programs, opioid addiction starts in most cases as the result of prescription painkillers. Usually, those pills have been overprescribed. They were never intended for long-term use, and it's very easy to become addicted, and the addiction is powerful. Addicts will do almost anything to get their next fix, and when they're cut off from the prescription version of opioids, they generally turn to the street and to heroin, which is readily available and cheaper. This deadly combination of factors leads to the alarming statistics about which we've spoken many times with medical professionals, law enforcement, and politicians. Governor Cooper was on this program just last month to address the state's response to this crisis. But today's program isn't about statistics. In fact, this crisis isn't about statistics. It's about people. And this hour, we meet two of the people who have been forever affected by the opioid epidemic. Sandy Tabor Gray is a Mooresville resident who overcame drug addiction as a teen. Her son, Michael, did not. He died at the age of 22 from a heroin overdose, and Sandy is now working to reduce prescription medication misuse. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome. Jay Wolf was a friend of Michael's and is himself a recovering opioid and heroin addict. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And they're both here in our Spirit Square studio, along with Dr. Stephen Wyatt, medical director of addiction medicine, at Carolina's healthcare system. Welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Mike.
You can join the conversation. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org, search for WFAE on Facebook, or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can join us on Facebook Live this morning. Let me begin with you, Sandy. There's a documentary, a wonderful documentary, actually, that was produced by WRAL-TV in Raleigh on the impact opioid addiction is having in North Carolina. And one thing comes through loud and clear, and in fact, you may have been the person in that documentary who said that this isn't happening on the other side of the tracks or downtown. It's happening in your neighborhood, in your home, in your schools, in your workplace. It's everywhere. Was that you who said that?
Yes.
Okay. Drug use has been going on forever. I think the first recorded use of opioids through poppies was 5,000 years ago or something like that. But you were addicted as a teen, not necessarily to opioids. What makes this different, this particular drug situation?
Well, I don't think it's just one thing that makes it different. I think, though, there's a lot of different pieces to it. And it's taken a while for everybody to come on board and see that everybody's got a piece in this, from the prescribing doctors to the environment to the person themselves. There's a lot of different pieces to this.
But is this, maybe I should ask the doctor this, is there something about opioids that make this more attractive, harder to kick? Once you've taken 1 week's worth of this stuff, are you just, I can't get enough of this? Is it stronger than anything else that we've been facing over the years?
I agree with what Sandy said. This is a problem that is multifaceted, that the right individual with the right genetic response to the opiate, with the right background often, with a whole host of things, and then the supply, then the availability has put significant numbers of people at risk.
We talked about this, I think, the last time you were on the program, Doctor, and I want to ask these two folks here in our studio, Sandy and Jay, about this. North Carolina and indeed the nation are both taking a different approach to this epidemic in drugs than we did traditionally in the so-called war on drugs, where we incarcerated a lot of people for mere possession, not even use, just having it on their person, and also for use and certainly for selling it. We're taking a medical approach to this, which is what we should be doing with all of it. But why have we changed our point of view on this? Why do you think we have changed our point of view on this, Jay?
Well, I think that opiates in general are just a way more powerful drug than, let's say, heroin, cocaine. Once you try it that first time, for me, when I experienced OxyContin for the first time, it was like it was built for me. when the doctor said something about genetics, I felt like I functioned, I was a better person when I was on opiates. And I chased that first feeling for the rest of my using. And it's just way more powerful. And I think that you can't go at it the traditional, let's just arrest our way out of this. There has to be treatment. There has to be education. It's just not, it's not like cocaine or crack.
But isn't the same true of every drug on the street right now? I mean, and the drugs that we have traditionally been arresting people for possession, isn't the same true? And I don't want to dwell
there's
on this.
There's a lot of similarities, definitely, yeah. In that there's a genetic predisposition to alcohol and mm-hmm. even marijuana, you know, as to how people respond to it. And so the idea that somehow we put people in jail for it, for the drug use disorder is not helpful.
So there are tens of thousands of people throughout this country who grapple with opioid addiction every single day. I read yesterday that more people have died from opioid overdoses than died in the Vietnam War. People are dying at a faster pace from opioids than they did at the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic. So put all these numbers into perspective. How do these numbers compare to other drug addictions and the negative results of those addictions?
Far more people die from alcohol use disorders than opioids. Far more, all right? But opioid disorders kill them right now, and that's what makes it so powerful that a young person injects drug or takes an overdose of pills and they die now. I've said before, it's not a matter of slowing the respirations of an individual when they overdose. It's actually stopping their brain's response to rising CO2 levels that they just suffocate.
They don't breathe.
They just don't breathe.
Mm. Jay, you talked about how this felt when you first took it.
Mm-hmm.
This drug was built for me.
Right.
Describe the impact. Describe the effects on you when you first take it, when you first took it, or mm-hmm. when you last took it. Was there a difference in the effect? And what is that effect? What is it that you said? What made you say, "This is built for me. I love this."
Well, it wipes away any anxiety. I just felt like I could. I was more confident. It kind of just flows through your body, and it's never the same again. I mean, the first few times you do it, it just grabs you. And I chased it. I did tons of things that I would never thought I would do in my entire life.
Like?
I mean, I injected heroin. I stole from my parents. I pawned gold. I found myself in places of Charlotte that I had no place being. I mean,
because you were looking for the next fix? Is that
correct?
Right?
Well, just the places you go to get the drugs.
Okay.
And I mean, you know, going into people's medicine cabinets, just I wasn't raised that way. I was raised, you know, by great parents. And I think that the misconception with a drug addict of being somebody on the streets is it's not the case anymore. There's tons of people raised by great parents that turn out just like how I did.
That was certainly the case with your son, Sandy Michael. He was raised not to do this and did. And you had experience with this, and I believe your husband had experience with drugs as well. Was it easier for you to spot this behavior in Michael?
Yes and no. It was easier to spot, but as a parent, you still want to believe your child when they're telling you, no, that's not what I'm doing, or no, you don't understand. And I would say to him, let me tell you what I was doing at your age. Mm-hmm. And I would try to be his mirror. And so many times he'd say, I am not like you, Mom. And I'd say, but let me tell you what I was doing. And in some cases, almost month for month, just so many years later, the same age, we were doing the same things.
Your son, Michael, first exposed, I understand, to opioids through prescription medication. As I've said in the past, this is how it happens for most people. He had severely broken his arm and at 15 and was prescribed these medications. How quickly did it progress? Did you notice any signs when he took the medication to relieve the pain in his broken arm that this was something that's going to be a problem going forward?
I didn't see it at that moment, but then I started seeing signs like weight loss, not caring about school, getting caught in lies, using my debit card when he hadn't asked for it.
How quickly did it happen after the medication was prescribed?
Mm, I don't know if I can really answer that honestly, but I would say within a year, I was starting to notice some significant things.
How long was the prescription for those painkillers? That's one of the problems here, that they're overprescribed and the length of time that they are prescribed is too long. How long was the prescription for? How many times was it renewed?
I really don't remember, but I'm sure it was a couple months, and I'm sure he milked it, you know, because I know what I was like at that age. So I know he was milking it. Did I relate it back to that at that moment? No, I did not.
Sandy Tabor Gray lost her son, Michael, to an opioid addiction. Jay Wolf is with us. He's a recovering addict. Dr. Stephen Wyatt's with Carolina's healthcare system, where he specializes in this. We're going to come back and talk more about the personal effects of this, not only with the person taking the drug, but for the families as well, when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the personal impact, the impact on human beings of the opioid epidemic, which is running rampant through the country and particularly in places like North Carolina. Dr. Stephen Wyatt is here, Medical Director of Addiction Medicine at Carolina's healthcare system. We also have with us two people who have been intimately affected by this. Sandy Tabor Gray, whose son Michael died of an opioid overdose at the age of 22. Jay Wolf is a recovering opioid and heroin addict and a friend of Michael's. I'm told that you were Michael's best friend. Did the two of you use these drugs together?
Definitely.
Did one of you introduce the other to opioids?
I don't personally remember that, and I don't think it's as simple as, like, oh, he gave it to me the first time, it's his fault, or anything like that. You're going to find it either way if you want to get it. And we used quite a bit together. We started probably with just hydrocodone, oxycodone, just whatever we could get. And then we started going down the OxyContin route, and this was before Purdue Pharmaceuticals changed their formula to... And they're basically, you can't abuse them now. You can't inject them. You can't snort them. We did that quite a lot. Mm.
When you do things like that together, I mean, what happens to your behavior? Do you even know that the other person's in the room once you get to the high? Are you just in your own little world? What happens?
No, I mean, you can function completely normally.
Okay.
I honestly thought I functioned better when I was on it.
Did you?
Yeah. I don't know. That was that. I'm not sure. I definitely thought I did.
So how did you become addicted to this? How did it happen for you?
I started, when I was 14, probably smoking weed, drinking beer.
Why?
Just to have fun. Yeah. Just hanging out with my friends. Mm-hmm. I probably started using opiates when I was 15, 16 years old. Honestly, I was first probably introduced with a hydrocodone cough syrup when I was younger with asthma. Mm-hmm. And like the doctor said before, it's just, I think genetically my makeup is built for opiates. I love them. I just feel better when I'm on them. So I, started getting down that road. And once you go down that road, there's no turning back. Your tolerance goes way up. The cost goes up. You start having to do things you never thought you would do. It feels like you need it to survive, basically.
So once your prescription for this, at the age of 12, to control your asthma, once your prescription ran out for things like that, how do you get your hands on it? How readily available is this in schools, in places where kids hang out?
It's readily available, but very expensive. And
how expensive is expensive?
Back when I was using, I would say an OxyContin 80 milligram pill was about $65.
And what will that do for you?
It'll get you good and high
for how long?
Depending on your tolerance, but early on I could do like 30 milligrams and feel great. Mm-hmm. Towards the end of my using, I could do probably 300 to 400 milligrams a day without looking back. I could spend over $200 without a problem.
At one point I read that your habit was costing you at least $100.
Yeah, and that was when I moved to heroin. It's not cost effective to do pills anymore. The only thing with heroin is you don't know what you're getting. With a pill, you know it was made in a lab, right? You know when you get a Roxycodone 30 with an M on it, you know that it was made in a pharmaceutical lab. Heroin comes from Mexico, comes from Afghanistan. It's cut with fentanyl. You never know what you're getting.
Let's talk about fentanyl for a second, because we've talked about this in the past, Dr. Wyatt. The fact that fentanyl is this synthetic drug. There's another one out there that's even more lethal, and it's fentanyl is a lot more powerful than the natural opioids, and you don't know what the purity of it is, and they're using fentanyl to increase the high from heroin, and it's so dangerous that one, I think, milligram of this stuff can kill you, like that.
Mm-hmm. Again, it depends on the tolerance to a degree, but there are 100 to 1,000 times the potency of heroin. So the effect is very rapid, and particularly the other form of fentanyl that you were trying to say, crafentanyl, is this extremely powerful fentanyl product that again, these medications are used very effectively in the hospital. They're used by anesthesia every day, but while they're monitoring the patient's respirations, they've taken control of the patient. For an individual to be using them on the street is suicidal, quite honestly.
And that's something that doesn't go through the mind of somebody who wants the fix. Is it even known by most people who are out there on the street trying to get these drugs? Do they even understand what they're risking? Do they care?
I've heard some crazy things, like someone will OD and people will actually go to that drug dealer to get the stuff because they know it's that good. Like, tolerance is huge. I mean, I was doing almost a gram a day of heroin. Someone early on the first time I did it, even with a huge opiate tolerance, I did like 0.1 of some tar and was, you know, wrecked for like 8 hours.
Okay.
Within 3 months, I was pretty much doing a gram a day.
You work all over the state with this situation and helping young people and also helping people understand what this means. His story is not uncommon, right?
Sandy? No, not at all. In fact, that's the norm. What you hear is going from the opiates to the heroin, and no thought about the care about your life, that this could take your life.
Right. Your son, Michael, as we said, got exposed to this at the age of 15 through prescription medication. And then what? What path did it take for him?
A lot of it, you know, I'm hearing after the fact. But he went from doing the pills and, you know, having the prescription and then taking it out of our medicine cabinets and then taking it out of friends' medicine cabinets and then getting to that point where he couldn't afford it, and he was introduced to heroin and started with heroin. And when he OD'd, he'd actually been clean for 4.5 months.
You actually took him to a drug treatment center in Tennessee, I want to say, because he had stolen from you, and you recognized this behavior because this was behavior that you indulged in as a younger person yourself. Did he fight you on going to that drug treatment center? Did he want to go? Did he understand that he needed help?
Oh, yes. He understood he needed help at that moment. I think Jay and I were talking about it on the way down here, that it was a moment of clarity for all of us. Like, you're not coming back into my house. And him realizing that what he had done to his parents, particularly his mom. I mean, we were very close, that this was the end.
Yeah. How many times did he go into rehabilitation? More times than once?
No, he'd been in twice. And then he, after the second time, which was in 2013, then he went to a sober living environment. And that's where he was.
Kind of a halfway house, not in rehab, but not home yet, that kind of a
right,
situation.
Right.
And on the weekend, one of the weekends, I guess he got a furlough and came home to be with you and his twin children.
Right.
And that's when he OD'd, correct?
Yes.
Where did he get the drug? I mean, when I read your story, it was that he went to bed that night, everything was fine. He said goodnight to his kids, Ted told him that he loved them, went to bed, and he didn't wake up. So
yeah.
When did he take the drug? How did he take it? How did it escape anybody's notice? Was it on his person all this time?
It must have been on his person. And he came home. We had spent the whole day together with his kids and with our whole family. And he asked to go out at night. He told me he was going to go and be with people in recovery. We agreed on what time he'd be home, and he came home right on the dot when he said he would. And I'm a late night person. He came in, he sat down, sat next to me, and one of the gifts of being in recovery is we could talk about that. And he knew that things weren't, he wasn't doing all that he could be doing. He never said that he had been using. He just said that there were some things he needed to change, to work on.
What was he high when he sat down next to you?
Not that I knew of, but my guess is probably yes.
So what do you think happened? Did he simply take too much of it, or was it laced with fentanyl and it killed him? Was it heroin? Was it?
It was heroin, and that at that moment, that's not what had killed him when he was sitting with me. Okay. He had more. Because it's more of a, you go into more of an instant overdose. It's not something that would have, he would have been able to sit and talk to me and then he would have gone. He obviously had shot up again.
Jay, talk to me about the craving. What is it that drives you to self-destruction? I know it feels good once you're on it, but what is it that makes you want it until you just can't say no?
Well, the biggest thing that I can think of is waking up in the morning being dope sick.
What does that mean?
It's basically opiate withdrawal, and the doctor would know more, but basically your receptors you don't have any dopamine left, and you need the opiate to release that dopamine for you. And you have symptoms such as, you know, restless legs. It's basically like having the flu, but knowing where the cure is, and all you have to do is get some money to go get it. And then once you're on it, you just want more.
It's pain relief.
Exactly.
Your body is creating its own natural pain.
By taking painkillers, you're creating pain, which needs more painkillers.
Dopamine is the natural substance in your brain that's released in the pleasure centers of your brain, correct? And what he's describing is that this supercharges your dopamine until the point where you don't have any more. And when you don't have any more, I mean, I'm sure he's describing it differently than you would, doctor, but when you don't have any more, gosh, you need it.
That's correct. It often is described as hijacking this pleasure center in terms of the levels of dopamine that are released. The levels are about seven times the effect that one would get from good food, good sex, watching their children grow, looking over the ocean at a sunset, you know, some things that are all designed to help us be healthier individuals and healthier in our society and create a healthier environment. What happens actually, two things. One, as a result of that huge dopamine release, that becomes the place where now people need to go to feel normal. Mm-hmm. That's really associated with the craving. The withdrawal is associated with another neurotransmitter, norepinephrine, and that's been sort of disengaged in a way, so that now for Jay to actually function appropriately on high doses of opiates, he needed to upregulate that norepinephrine significantly. And when he takes it away, people go into withdrawal. So it's not the cycle. Dopamine. Dopamine has more to do with the mood and with that ongoing craving that can last for long periods of time, as Sandy described, her son still having cravings, you know, 3 or 4 months later. And that's the problem with putting people potentially in a controlled environment and then releasing them, because in the controlled environment with very little in the way of stimulant to use drug, they can start to talk well, they can reengage with their families, they can do all kinds of stuff. And then they get out, they potentially relapse because this craving just doesn't go away, and people say treatment doesn't work.
How many times have you been in treatment, Jay?
Twice.
What took you there? Did somebody make you go, or did you say, I have to do this?
No, I had been stealing, and my parents had found a pawn ticket in my wallet that I had pawned some of their gold. And they confronted me about it. And in that moment of clarity, I confessed. And that was basically the end of me hiding everything. They had known I had been arrested once before, and they had known that I had been a drug user. But
so when was the first time you went to rehabilitation?
When? August of 2011.
And how long did that last?
I was there for 28 days. And just to give a story about how powerful it is, I got out. I had around 30 days clean, and I was in a halfway house, and I had the ability to go get my car. And so I did, and my dad gave me some money to go back up and have for food and gas and stuff. Mm-hmm. I went straight from my parents' house with my car to Charlotte and bought some Opanas, so oxymorphone. And knowing that when I got back, I was going to get caught, and it didn't matter to me. I still did it.
Even after 30
even
days?
Even 30 days clean. Mm-hmm.
What when we come back, I'll talk about what happens in rehab. But then you went back into rehab later on.
Correct.
Was it right then, or was it later on?
I lasted a couple weeks, and then I went to a different program.
And how long were you there?
The different program?
Yes.
72 days.
And how long have you been sober, if you are sober right now?
6 years tomorrow.
6 years tomorrow. And you are sober right now?
Yes, sir.
How difficult is it?
Not that hard.
Why?
What happened? I don't know. I just think something changed. And I don't really know how to explain it, but I think it's spiritual in nature, but that's really all I can say about it.
I want to talk about treatment. I want to talk about what happens in rehab to people. I want to talk to you, Sandy, about one of the things that you're doing to raise awareness about the fact that these drugs are so readily available in people's medicine cabinets. When we come back, it's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Jay Wolf, who's a recovering opioid addict. Sandy Tabor Gray, her son Michael, died of an overdose from opioids. Dr. Stephen Wyatt is medical director of addiction medicine at Carolina's healthcare system and deals with this every day. You said a minute ago, Jay, that something clicked at some point after going through rehab the second time where you just, you've been sober how long again? I'm sorry.
I was in the program for 72 days.
But how long have you been sober since leaving?
6 years tomorrow.
6 years tomorrow. And I said, why? And you said, well, just something changed.
Right.
What?
I'm not really sure. It's just something happens. And I can't really explain it.
You and your husband were drug users in your youth, Sandy. Obviously, it's worked for you. You're sober, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened?
Lifestyle changes. You know, it was suggested to me to change my playgrounds and my playmates. That was the first thing, meaning where I was hanging out and who I was hanging out with. And when you start taking suggestions of ways that your life could be better, and I think for me, I was at that moment of desperation. I was done living the life I was living.
Do you have to hit rock bottom to come out of this?
I don't think so. I'm afraid to say that when okay. It comes to opiate addiction.
You said off the air a minute ago that it's gone out of my head. I'm sorry, it went out of my head. Let's talk about treatment. When you're in a rehabilitation situation, what goes on?
Well, I went to a standard 28-day program first, the same one as Michael. Just a couple years afterwards, and they basically just talk about it, you know, try to educate you. The second time,
what do they say to you that can possibly get through the cravings and the need that your body?
Well, there you're in kind of an environment where you can't get anything,
right?
So it's different than when you're out. But when the second time I went to a wilderness program, which is basically you go into the woods and they take away everything from you except for your. You know, it's more primitive than anything. And that's where I kind of found that spiritual thing I was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Just all I could think about was, you know, it was hiking and food and like all that thing. The drugs are taken away from you and you're just more focused on the primitive stuff.
And
food, shelter, water.
And that seemed to work for you.
It did.
Evidently.
Yeah.
What about medications, doctor? I mean, there are, I know, drugs that supplant the cravings, at least while you're taking them. There are other drugs that make it impossible for you to take opioids while you're on them. How does that work?
So the two medications that will reduce the drive to use drug because they satiate the drive are methadone and buprenorphine or Suboxone. And those medications work a little differently. Methadone is a full opiate agonist, and that's why it's
what
so
does that
tightly
mean?
Controlled. It means that the more you take, the more the effect it is. And certainly many people have died of an overdose from methadone, and that's why people go to a methadone treatment center on a daily basis. The methadone is actually administered on site. So
does that ultimately wean you from the need for opioids, or does it simply supplant the drug with something that's safer and controlled because you're getting it at a clinic?
Both. So it does allow the person to get into a more stable state to start to move forward in their lives. And there's no question that It has reduced HIV, Hep C, overdose deaths. I mean, that's been
because
documented.
Of needle sharing.
Oh, my goodness, for many years. And there's more people than people would realize that are out functioning very well, and they are taking methadone on a daily basis. The same is true, really, with buprenorphine, Suboxone.
Yeah.
But that medicine is not, it's referred to as a partial agonist, so it gets about 40% of the effect of methadone, and it levels off. It doesn't go any higher than that. It doesn't result in overdose. And in fact, it protects, both medicines actually have a higher affinity, a stronger bond to the opioid receptor, so that a person actually can't use effectively at all at certain doses any other drug. So it protects people from using other
drugs.
Have
you, Jay, or was Michael on any of these things that we're talking about here?
I've taken methadone and Suboxone, and I definitely feel like you can get high on both, methadone more so. The problem with methadone, I believe, is the withdrawal from it is terrible. I mean, the half-life of methadone and buprenorphine is really long, so the withdrawal period can be longer, especially with methadone, I think. Suboxone, I think they're both just temporary, so it's a Band-Aid on like a bleeding wound, like an artery.
Right.
Suboxone, maybe not as much. I think it can help people, but I don't think it's a long-term solution.
Dick in Salisbury writes, the reason why opiates are different from other drugs and the reason why it is spread through all segments of society is how use starts. Many users have unbearable pain. They logically seek medical help. They're often prescribed painkillers, which are opiates, and by golly, it works, and they receive a great deal of relief. Your trusted doctor tells you to take the opiates, and it makes your pain bearable. Why in the world would you not take the medicine? The next thing you know, you're addicted. Which leads me to the question about what you're doing, Sandy, out in the world. You're working to raise awareness of safe drug use, of safe drug storage, and safe drug disposal. Most of us keep our drugs in medicine cabinets or vanity drawers in our bathroom, and we don't think about them being there. Talk about that.
Well, we're long past that time where that's a safe place to keep your medicine, because anybody walking into your house, it can be somebody who's there to clean your house or a plumber or an electrician, could have an ulterior motive for coming into your house. I've even gone and spoken to realtor offices about when you do open houses, make sure that your medicine is put away, because we hear stories about people going to open houses seeking.
They're just going there
to
go through
pills.
Your medicine cabinet.
Right. I know we're not into the statistics, but, you know, just in 2016 in Iredell County alone, over 12 million opiates were prescribed. Mm-hmm. 12 million. That was enough for every man, woman, and child to have several. Now,
so if you're legitimately prescribed an opioid medication for pain and your pain goes away because you've healed and you still haven't used everything in the bottle, what do you do with it?
Well, I know, and this is in Mecklenburg too, but I know in Iredell County, all four of the police departments have drop boxes, and most of them are 24/7. You can just go and you can just drop your medicine into the box. There's not anybody standing there looking to see what you're putting in there, and you just dispose of it.
Although we are profligate in so many ways in this country because we are so wealthy in comparison to a lot of the rest of the world, people have been stingy with throwing away medicine because they paid for it. I may need it again. You may need the pain medication again, so I'll hang on to it. And people have a nasty habit sometimes of seeing a friend in pain. It could be or a friend having a problem that their antibiotic helped with, and they'll offer them their prescription. And the same is true for these pain medications.
Absolutely.
Shouldn't do it?
Absolutely not, because when that pain medicine has been prescribed to you, mm-hmm. there have been a lot of things that have been taken into account. You know, your height, your weight, your past prescriptions possibly, what else you're on. There's so much that goes into a doctor writing that prescription.
Yeah.
So when that is being given to somebody else, you don't know any of that other background.
It's illegal to give it to anyone
And
else.
It's illegal.
That doesn't stop a lot of people.
Yeah,
That's true.
It's illegal. It's illegal to give it to your child if they sprain their ankle. It's illegal to give it to your wife if she has a headache. It's illegal to use a narcotic, a controlled substance, in any way other than how it was prescribed. So literally, it is it's not legal to have had a broken arm, have opiates in your medicine chest, and get a bad headache and use it. That's misuse, certainly, of the medication.
You've described Michael as one of your best friends. Mm-hmm. Was his death not a wake-up call for you?
Well, I was sober when he died.
Okay. Did you have other friends who have overdosed on this?
I mean, I know tons of people that have died, yeah.
And that wasn't a wake-up
call?
Well,
they weren't necessarily friends with Michael, but Michael, I don't know, is it okay if I share about him ODing? Yeah. So Michael had ODed previously, and I was with him.
Okay.
And, you know, that didn't stop him.
Was it naloxone? Is that what it is? Was that available? Is that what brought him out of
it? No, he had a seizure, and he actually came out of it on his own.
And it didn't stop him?
No.
That's what the pull, that's how strong
Correct.
The desire and the pull is. And we know how we've done a number of programs on this, and the information about the strength of these drugs and the addictive nature of these drugs is so compelling. That doesn't stop people from trying. It doesn't stop kids from trying. Is that because they think they're invulnerable? It won't happen to them.
I think so. And I think it's a lot of the other stuff, the peer pressure and wanting to fit in and all that stuff that goes along with that age group.
You and your husband obviously were addicted to other substances, not to this one. Do you think that your family has a genetic disposition?
Oh, yeah. Yes. And we knew there was a chance.
Did you talk about that with Michael?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Are you talking about that with his kids?
Not yet.
They're six. Too young? Okay.
Too young. But we know that conversation is coming. We know the conversation is coming about how their dad died.
I referenced the WRAL-TV documentary that you are part of, Sandy, at the beginning of this program. It really is well done. And in that documentary, another woman talks about the grandmother of their daughter who died from an overdose. And the grandmother wanted to ask the girl's mother, what should I tell people at church when they ask about her? Tell the truth, she said. Tell them she died from an overdose. That's hard for a lot of people. There's still a stigma attached to drug use and to drug overdosing and dying from drug use. What do you say to that?
Well, that's why I'm as open as I am about my own history and what happened with Michael. You know, we're part of a very large church in Mooresville, and, you know, being in recovery has blessed me with being able to go out and serve in my community. And so our family was pretty well known in our area for things that we've done. And, you know, I was pretty open about Michael's addiction.
Is it difficult for you to talk about Michael, even though you know you're helping? You might be helping somebody
Absolutely.
Else.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's difficult or absolutely you're helping?
Absolutely, it's difficult, and I hope I'm helping. I hope whether I'm helping, you know, somebody who's struggling with addiction, and to know that there is hope and there is recovery. They hear Jay's story, they hear my story, and I hope I'm helping a family that says, you know what, there is a way out of this.
Difficult for you to tell your story? Is it embarrassing in any way?
No, I don't.
Do you feel judged in any way by people when you tell them?
No, not at all.
One of the things that you're trying to tear down, Sandy, is the stigma of what an addict looks like. So what does an addict look like?
Looks like me. Looks like Jay. You know, and then it looks like maybe the idea that you see on the street. But more often than not, you're not even knowing when you're in the room with somebody who's addicted.
I don't know that words of advice can help people who might or might be taking now or might be thinking about taking or might have never thought about it but will go to a party tonight with their friends and, well, I'll try it. What word of advice would you give them, Jay or Sandy?
Yeah.
Aside from don't.
That's really the strongest one is don't. You don't know what you're taking.
If you are hooked already, what word of advice would you give that person? If they will listen to you.
I mean, it's never too late to turn your life around. I mean, I did, and I'm married. I have a house. Like, my life has changed completely from where I was when I was 20 years old.
Jay Wolf, recovering opioid heroin addict. Good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
Sandy Tabor Gray, whose son Michael died of an opioid overdose, and Dr. Stephen Wyatt, medical director of addiction medicine at Carolina's Healthcare System. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.